Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome back to Pixels, a bi-monthly show where we cover the world of gaming and the news that come out of that world. We cover PC games, console games, mobile games even. My name is Patrick Beja, and today, again, I am joined by the one, the only, Garrett Weindroll, who basically, when was it, last week or 10 days ago, saw the Destiny 2 announcement and sent me a tweet saying, "I'm so jazzed about Destiny 2. We have to talk about Destiny 2. I have to come on Pixels." Is that an accurate rendition of your tweet?
I believe my exact wording in a DM to you was "shotgun next Pixels." Like, I think within 5 minutes of the Destiny 2 conference ending.
Which, you know, it's really cool to see people who are incredibly excited about Destiny 2. I feel like it's a lot of people who are, well, who were excited about Destiny 1. But we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about quite a few things. We're also going to talk about the Nintendo news, including the Global Test Bunch, which was the beta test for ARMS, which I tried. I'll tell you what I thought. I can't remember. Do you have a Switch?
I do. I was one of the lucky ones that did not pre-order, did not make any plans.
Oh, right. And, you just showed up.
I managed to find one on launch day, and I have friends locally who still have not managed to find one.
So did you try the test punch?
Such a I did not name. Try the test punch. No, I was unaware that was happening.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Patrick, you come on. My usual podcast week is very Blizzard focused. I'm not always on the up and up on Nintendo tests.
Yeah, understandable. Okay, that's fair enough. There's a bunch of other little tidbits for Nintendo. There's the controversy about Far Cry 5, which is an interesting one we'll get into, and then a bunch of other little bits. But first, Destiny 2, we have information. Oh, you know,
yes, we do. many informations.
Many informations. You know, it's funny because Destiny 2 is this thing that is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, super exciting for a lot of people. And I'm not quite sure it's as exciting to many other people who were disappointed by the first one. It's one of those things where if you enjoyed the first episode, then you think this is the best thing ever. And if you haven't, it's kind of whatever. I'm sure there are other examples of this, in the world of gaming and in many worlds. But so it means I'm not quite sure exactly how to approach the presentation of Destiny 2 for this show, because I don't want to make it about like a Destiny fan thing. But at the same time, if it's not fans talking about the game, then it's really just, hey, Destiny is kind of different than number two, but it's still really Destiny, which might be a good place to start. This doesn't feel like a huge change of the formula, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I think you're being pretty fair with your assessment there. I think the most accurate thing I've heard like all week, now all 2 weeks since it was since the conference, was, "Hey, this looks like what Destiny always should have been," and I completely agree with that. I do think it's a little cynical and whatnot, but I think it's very accurate. And I was one of those people who was disappointed with the original Destiny, but Taken King really kind of brought me back.
I think that was the reaction for many, many people, and we've talked about it quite often, how the Taken King fixed a lot of things from the existing offering of Destiny. It seems like this is kind of an expansion on that, with more activities, more stuff to do. That was kind of the speech they made in the beginning. It was like, what they want Destiny to be is a place to hang out where you always have something to do and always have people to play with, which is absolutely a something that we should appreciate. But I guess another question is, does this deserve the number two? I'm not sure we can answer this yet, but does it deserve the number two appendage? Or is it really just they realized that people were disappointed with the first one, so they figured we're going to make basically a big expansion, call it number two, people will show up?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it remains to be seen. Although at the end of the day, I would say hopefully they just went back to square one and kind of redid their engine. So because we've all heard the horror stories of how hard it was to develop Destiny 2 because of their internal tools. So I would say if just from a technical aspect, it is Destiny 2, which means that their development cycle is better and less painful, that'll make me happy.
Get that they can add things to the game without having to wait a week for it to like internally render or something when they
Yes, we've all heard that horror story about how long it took for them to render the world to make changes, and then if it crashed, they just lost days of work
to load the world and stuff. You know, I think one of the things people are curious about is going to be, is this more of a an MMO than Destiny 1 was? Because obviously people will remember we kind of were hoping an FPS MMO because of the lack of communication on their part. And it turned out that this was really a shared world shooter. Was that the way they called it? I can't remember who coined that phrase, but it was more of a Diablo shooter than it was an MMO with persistent world with lots and lots of people in the same place. I feel like this is still going to be the same thing. So let's talk about maybe the things that are changing, you know, what the information we got and the things that are not changing. The first part, the most important one maybe for new players, is going to be the cinematic storytelling of the solo campaign, which was absolutely absent from the first game. Better in The Taken King, as most things were. that seemed like it was, of course, we've only seen one mission, but it did seem like it had a story that made sense, which I think a lot of people are going to go like, well, duh, if they didn't play the first one. But for us, it's kind of a revolutionary move in the Destiny world. What did you think of like the way they brought people in and they drew people in with the story?
Oh, I think they did a very good job. It looks to me like that's going to be our intro into Destiny. So I mean, I don't know how well they'll be able to keep that up. And I wouldn't expect that level of polish from all of the missions, because it also sounds like we're getting more traditional side quests, which I'm actually rather excited for. But I thought the demo that we got to see there was, it looked pretty darn epic. And like you said, it actually had a plot that I could follow, which seems like a hilarious thing to compliment. But if you play the original Destiny, you'd realize that is that's something that was lacking.
That's not a given. Yeah. So basically, you're gonna get they found a story artifact to take all the gear away from everyone. Basically, the old base is destroyed. Our masters for each class are scattered. We have four planets, as we did in the original game, but they did mention the zones, specifically the European Dead Zone, which is the zone on the Earth. is twice as big than any zone that they've had in the past, which I don't think is incredibly significant. It's still, I mean, it's bigger, it's cool, but it's still a zone which is not like an open world kind of area. But we're still going to have like four different planets, fairly different environments. One of them is like an eternal sea of methane.
Titan, which I really like the concept of in general. Like overall, just the art, I'm very excited about the direction they're taking their planets in this one.
Yeah. The other one I really liked was, I can't remember the name of it, but basically it's a planet that has been colonized by the robotic race of the game, the Vex, and they have all sorts of weird structures in there, and it has its own fauna, and so there's a lot of personality to each planet, which I think wasn't, you know, it was the case in the first one, but it's not, it seems even more pronounced in this one. But it's still four planets, right? It's the same as the first game.
Yes. But if the zones are larger, which once again, Patrick, I agree with you, is not hard to accomplish compared to the first game. It's still, I mean, that's a huge boon in my book. And also, like, just seeing Earth was one of the biggest disappointments for me in the first one. I was like, wow, like there's like leading up to it in the promotions for the game, I was like, this is a very unique science fiction world. I can't wait to see what they did with Earth. And I mean, everything, because it's all taking place within our solar system. And then I get to Earth and I get like a very small rust bucket. It's like all I get to see of Earth.
So, yeah, basically anything beyond that is making us happy. It's very, you know, ironic / difficult to... We in the Destiny community absolutely understand why this is genuinely exciting. I think it's very difficult to communicate that excitement to people outside of the Destiny community, because everyone looks at what we're talking about and is going like, eh, you know, or like, oh, okay, well, I guess it's the same. And I don't know. But if you know, for example, what happened in Taken King, that one zone where it was so rich, like so dense, there were so many things to discover, so many activities, so many little things that you would get curious about, and you go and explore, and you hear something when you're somewhere near a specific place, and you know it's unusual, so you explore it a little bit further, and then you realize that it says something about another place, so you go explore that. And a lot of the discovery and sense of exploration was conveyed incredibly well, especially in the Taken King, not so much in the original one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Destiny, the original one,
let's not talk about it anymore, right?
what I was going to say is I think it's a game that's just very easy to make fun of. Like it's, but I think if you enjoyed it, you enjoyed something despite many extremely apparent faults. So if you did enjoy it, which I think you and I both fall into the category of, that Destiny 2 is a very exciting prospect.
Yeah. And they're talking about many other things you can do. There are going to be, as you said, some kind of side quests, some adventures that you can go on in the middle of your regular quest. There's the things that they're adding are building blocks on what became, after a couple of years, a solid base for the game. So there's lots of things to do on the planets. There's no more need to return to orbit, which was an infuriating bit of interface design or networking design. You had to basically go back to orbit, load out of the zone, and then load back into another one. Now you can just select the place you want to go to, and you're going to load into there. You have a map, and you know, I'm not absolutely certain we needed a map, but we're going to get one. And you're going to be able to go to the different places very quickly. There's basically, they're making the new subclasses into variations on the previous ones. But what was fun, I think it's a good time to talk about the core fun of Destiny. And we've mentioned it a few times, but really what's really fun about Destiny is the gunplay, the core gameplay loop of being in the game in an FPS and it feeling so right. And it feels joyful to be shooting at all of those enemies. And every few minutes, every 2 or 3 minutes, you get that super. And again, especially since the Taken King happened, the supers are what they call roaming supers. So it's not in the beginning, in the original game, it was just basically one action. So you would throw a bubble to protect your team, kind of a barrier, or you would throw a massive projectile that would explode everything in the where you threw it. But that was it. In the Taken King, they turned them into active things where you would be in that state for 10-15 seconds, and you would fry everything in the surroundings.
And you got to have this ones, like hero moment, and because exactly. of the three classes, there's not a lot to differentiate the three classes in Destiny aside from the supers, and it gives you this kind of, I think of it like this Avengers moment where you all get to kind of show off.
That is a perfect way to say that. And especially, you know, Avengers, given that one of the new supers is basically Captain America. So,
oh, I'm manning a Titan from day one. I'm going to be Captain America. I can't wait.
And it really feels, it makes you feel like an incredible badass, you know, for those, like, it's a badass simulator. It makes you feel like you're the strongest character on the planet. You're frying everyone, you're throwing hammers at everyone. And in this one, you know, you have similarly those flaming swords that you throw on the ground, and you're like, you leap from place to place, and it feels great. And that, the core part of the game, is still there. There are some minor things that are changing. The way the weapons loadouts work are a little bit different. That's going to be details for anyone who hasn't been hardcore into Destiny. The PvP environment is going to be 4v4 instead of 6v6. So they hope to make that a little bit more balanced and controllable because it was a little bit of a mess in the 6v6 PvP games. I enjoyed it, but I'm not a big PvP guy. And there's another feature which was, I think, the most interesting one that they talked about in the game. One of the most famous, I don't want to say shortcoming, but, well, actually, I do want to say shortcomings, but it really isn't of the game, that is a philosophical design choice, is the fact that they don't have matchmaking for all of the activities. For the hardest ones, basically the strikes, which are dungeons, the hard version, the Nightfall strikes. Nightfall strikes, it's three people. The dungeon activities are three people, and the raids are six people. So for both of those, you can't queue in and get into them. You actually have to go in and find people to form a group via, you know, your friends, social platforms, outside platforms. And it's never felt it. Every time I managed to get into a game with this, it was great because you actually knew the people, you were discussing things a little bit, and it was usually, maybe not 100% of the time, but usually it was great. And the challenges were so satisfying when you managed to overcome them. There wasn't any of the trivial feeling that you have when you have random matchmaking. So, but they didn't want to go to random matchmaking. So what they're doing is what they're calling guided games, which is a system where a clan, which, by the way, is also going to be included in the game and managed by the game.
Finally.
Which it wasn't before, yeah. So a clan that has four or five players for a raid can elect to get one or two additional players from the pool of random solo players to accompany them in the raid. And they can explain the spirit in which they're doing it, you know, if they're tryhards, if they need you to know everything there is to know, or if they can accompany you and teach you the ropes. And you can decide whether or not you want to join this or that clan for that thing. I think it's a great idea. I do have a little bit of a concern regarding the imbalance in numbers between number of clans that are going to be offering that kind of experience and at any given time, and number of solo players which are going to want to take part. I think there are going to be a ton of solo players and only a few clans available for those.
I agree. I think this is one of the, this is probably simultaneously the most interesting and the most skeptical feature being added for me. Social engineering fascinates me in online multiplayer games, and that's clearly what they're trying to do here. They even brought up toxicity like in their conference, and it's like, of course that's in the back of their mind. How do you curate a social experience and try and minimize player toxicity as much as humanly possible?
So do you think that would work with this system?
I do not know, but I think it is one of the most unique approaches I've seen so far.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I've maybe another game has used a system like this one before, but I haven't seen it. And I think it could be quite efficient, because imagine if you're the one person or the two people who show up in a group of people that already know each other, converse, via voice chat and know the encounter, know what they're doing, or at least know what they're trying to do. It becomes really hard to be a jerk yourself, right?
Yes. I used to do pickup raids in WoW, like back in Lich King, and okay. they were still very positive experiences, because at the time there weren't really tools in the game to make it easy. So by the time we actually got the group together, we were all kind of like, we're here to actually get something done. And we, if someone messed up, we didn't flame them. We taught them what they were doing wrong and how to do better.
Right.
Now, that's not always the case. I'm sure other folks out there are like, oh, man, Garrett, I did the same thing. It was a terrible experience. But it's just interesting. And I mean, really, at the end of the day, I saw every possible thing I could in Destiny as a solo player. And sadly, that it did not involve the raids.
Any of the raids?
No, I did not do any of the raids because my friends were spread across both consoles. I played on both consoles to try and play with my friends, but by the time I could never herd enough cats into the same group to get a raid done. And it sounds like I am not alone in this, because it sounds like, for like the verbiage that they chose to use in this conference, that Bungie kind of ran into the same issues that Blizzard did during vanilla World of Warcraft, where they're just like, hey, like three guilds saw Naxxramas, guys, why did we spend this much time building this?
Yeah, that's basically the issue. Although there were communities online on the PlayStation Network, you know, there are those community group things that happened in the middle of the lifespan of Destiny 1, which helped a little bit. There were also outside websites that you would go to and register, and like people would send you invites pretty quickly. So I did end up seeing one of the raids, the raid from the Taken King. And you know, I'm really sad that you didn't get to experience it, because it was a very cool experience. Like,
oh, everyone I've talked to when I mentioned that, they're just like, you missed the best thing in all of Destiny, which were the raids. So
it's definitely, you know, it's hard to explain, because people who have played MMORPGs kind of know what raids are, but when you're doing it in first person view, it is different. And the mechanics, at least on the raid I've seen, but even in the intro of the original raid, which is something I did, it is very special. You know, there are, I don't know why it feels so different from an MMO, but you know, in an MMO, you're at a distance from your character. You're looking at everything from above, and you're seeing crap on the ground you shouldn't stand on, and you feel like, you know, you're controlling another character. But obviously, in a first person shooter, you're in the middle of it. And one of the encounters I remember is the first one for the first raid. So it's six people. You have four spots you have to stand in, and you have to stand on them in order to, three spots, so three groups of two, and you have to stand on them in order to activate this door that will open to let you enter in the raid. And there are a couple of things there. First of all, when you stand on there, of course, the enemies start showing up, and you have to collaborate with two people and sometimes call out on a third one because you're not managing to kill enough of them, and one of your guys died, and like, it's very hectic, very cool. But the other thing is also, none of this was explained in any way. So you would go there, and that's been a common thread in Destiny. You would go there and try stuff. You know, you would stand in the thing, and you would see the thing that would start lighting up. So you would go, you find another thing and try to stand on both of them. And, oh, right, okay, I started understanding. This one is very simple, but there are a lot of them like this. And it's, I don't know, again, there is something very special about that experience, which is unique to the Destiny raids. Not, you know, regarding the game, but also regarding games in general. Like, I haven't really had that experience anywhere else. So it's very cool. And the raids for the, so complex as well. The things you have to do are not easy. And anyway, it's just great fun. I'm really hoping this works out at least a little bit so that we can experience the raids. More people can experience the raids. And then we get to the technical stuff. It is going to be on PC as well. We'll get to Battle.net in just a second, but it won't have cross-save. That is one disappointing aspect of it. At least we were hoping, you know, cross-save between consoles and PCs, but that's not going to be possible. The PC version might not make it in time for the release of September 8th. And they won't have dedicated servers, which is really an interesting thing to explain. I'm not going to get too much into it, but if you have the opportunity, go check out the GDC talk by Justin Truman about Destiny's network mission architecture, which is incredibly geeky and incredibly nerdy. It's basically how the network system works in Destiny. And I'm not going to go into all of it because, first of all, I didn't understand all of it, but it was super interesting. And what it comes down to is I think a lot of people don't understand a lot of the brilliant work that went into designing the interface of Destiny. They really came from a Halo background, and that was their starting point. And they tried to figure out how can we make a Halo like game, but where the world is shared by everyone and anyone can go from any place to any place all the time. And we still have that P2P architecture hybrid with servers that are holding some of the information of the world, but enough that the transitions can be smooth and you never feel like you're transitioning from one thing to the other. And when you understand that, I think there's a lot of how Destiny works, which becomes a lot clearer. Why the scope of Destiny isn't as big as people had hoped. Why there are this number of people per instance, quote unquote, which they call bubble. Why they're doing it still with P2P rather than having dedicated servers. I'll boil it down. Basically, it's so that it's doable, understand, you know, cost-wise, but that it's doable. But it's very cleverly done. It might not be the best solution for super competitive, extra hardcore PvP players, because they might be feeling a little bit more lag. But it's a really, anyway, it's very clever. And it explains a lot of their thought process going from Halo to Destiny. I really encourage you, if you're interested in these kinds of things, it's called Destiny's Networked Mission Architecture by Justin Truman, and it's available as a GDC talk, which is, again, fascinating. But yeah, so Battle.net, we're two giant Blizzard nerds.
We are. That is a true statement.
What did you think when we saw Mike Morhaime's face appear in the live stream and he said, it's going to be on Battle.net?
Oh, man, I feel like I've mentioned my reaction so many times now, but like it's boiled down to this was the most surprising thing of the entire damn conference for me. And then afterwards, it seems like a no-brainer and I feel really dumb.
It's, you know, it is a no-brainer. I think there's a lot to discuss about the implications for Blizzard, for Activision, which we can get into. But the essential aspect of it is that I think this is a perfect storm for Bungie, Activision, and Blizzard. And as you said, it's kind of obvious that they're going to do it like this. I mean, first of all, they need to bring the game on PC. They're working with Activision in very close partnership. Activision Blizzard already has Blizzard's launcher. Why not put it there? Like, why go spend incredible amounts of money developing something like that? Because it's going to be taking leveraging the entire social infrastructure of the Blizzard app. And so, first of all, you need to build that. And second of all, why give 30% to Steam, to Valve? There's no reason to do that.
Nope, right? No, there's not. Yeah, which is exactly why I said after I thought about it for more than 5 minutes, I felt extremely dumb for not seeing this coming.
And it's also, you know, I think it makes sense from a financial standpoint, but it also makes sense from a community standpoint. The two games I keep referencing when I'm talking about Destiny are World of Warcraft and Diablo, Diablo 3 more specifically. They are perfect for that community. You know, I wonder what kind of reaction you've seen from people in the Blizzard communities. But
it's all been very, very positive for the most part. Like, I don't think I've heard from a single person like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. It does just make sense. It is definitely strange and new that we're getting a non Blizzard game on the just rebranded Blizzard app, which now seems like they should have just kept it Battle.net because now it's not all Blizzard games. But I mean, now that it's there, I mean, Destiny, it's a loot game. It's a social experience. And that's pretty much what Blizzard is known for making at this point. I mean, there was a point where RTS was their bread and butter, but it's not really anymore.
Yeah. And you know, the most people have been telling me, you know, I probably wouldn't have tried Destiny otherwise, but if I'm going to see it on the Blizzard launcher, maybe I'll give it a try. And some people were saying, it feels dirty, it feels weird that there's going to be a non-Blizzard game on the Blizzard app, and I understand that feeling. I think it's like I've said this in other places, but I think it's like someone who's a super fan of Apple seeing a Microsoft product in an Apple store. They'd be like, wait, that's out of place. That doesn't work. And seeing, you know, the little toast, the pop-ups in the chat, seeing someone with the Destiny icon when you're playing, I don't know, Overwatch or World of Warcraft, that's going to be weird. But
I'm fine with it.
Fine. I'm fine.
I couldn't have a more biased reaction because my single greatest pain with the original Destiny, besides the initial launch where I think it was deeply flawed, was the social aspect. It was a social game where I was just fighting against the game itself to have a social experience. And for me, the Blizzard like ecosphere is my social experience online.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's there's that, and there's also the fact that, you know, the Blizzard launcher is absolutely 100% premium prime real estate. Right. So that's going to put the game in front of many, 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 many people's eyes, as we mentioned, that might not have checked it out otherwise. But it's like it's hard to explain. It's kind of like managing to put your product on primetime TV, you know, everyone like on super targeted primetime TV. You're talking to people who might be interested in it, who will see it and have their attention captured by that placement. You know, just the fact that there's an icon, and I'm sure there are going to be some promos on the other games tabs and all of that. But
I better get a ghost pet in WoW that tells me wizards came from the moon.
You know, I don't know if they're going to do that. It would be cool. I think it would be very nice. Some people mentioned, you know, seeing Destiny characters in Heroes of the Storm. I'm sure that would be a more complicated, you know, difficult proposition.
Well, they'd have to make a character in a kit and all that jazz. But I mean, Ana in Overwatch basically already has a Destiny skin. So
yeah, there is one that is very reminiscent of that. That's true.
Well, it's Destiny is all get out.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, we've been talking about Destiny 2 for 30 minutes. I think that should summarize our excitement for the game. I can't wait. I'm thinking I'm probably going to get it on consoles if it comes out on consoles first, and then I'll get it on PC anyway.
That's my thought process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to get, you know, into the marketing machine that will make me buy two copies. What can I say? It's okay. It's for work. It's for work.
Business expense.
Sorry?
Business expense.
Exactly. Of course. Absolutely. So, you know, when you're a one-person company, it still means money out of your pocket, but a little bit less because of the taxes and all of that. So.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
All right. Let's talk about Nintendo for a little bit. As some people knew, apparently not Garrett, the test bunch for ARMS happened this weekend. There's another one next week, I think. Is it next week or the one after? I think it might be next week. So you still have a chance to try it out before it comes out. But so it was 3 times 1 hour. I got the opportunity to play it for about half an hour. I didn't, spoiler, I didn't really feel the need to play more than that half an hour.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
I mean, I've seen a lot of very positive feedback. Some people seem to love that game. I didn't quite hate it, but I think I didn't really understand it. And you know, I come from a background of love for fighting games. So, oh, by the way, I need to pre-order Tekken 7. It's coming out in 3 days. Boom.
Oh, for crying out loud, Patrick. There's a character. I mean, ARMS, would you call ARMS a fighting game? Because to me, it doesn't look like a Tekken or a Street Fighter or a Mortal Kombat. It's almost like calling like Smash Brothers a fighting game.
Well, I think you just offended a lot of Smash Brothers fans. They are.
I'm a Smash Brothers fan. It's its own thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like you have your Tekkens, your Street Fighters, your Mortal Kombats, which all kind of live within, I think, a very specific genre. And then I think you have games like Super Smash Brothers Brawl and Melee and so on and so forth that they're just very unique in what they do.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And certainly ARMS is very unique. So I'm not going to describe it. I'm sure everyone knows what ARMS is. But the takeaway I got is that it's quite fun. Silly fun. The matches are really short, so you can chain them very quickly. They're about, a minute, 100 seconds each, I think, a minute and a half. It's just one round. There's a good variety of games. Basically, you get randomly, in that mode at least, you get randomly put in different modes. So you have 2v2 sometimes. You also have like 3 people free-for-all. You have a weird beach ball game that also comes up sometimes. The lobby is really clever. Basically, you're in put automatically in a lobby where you have basically little pictures of your avatar as a visual representation of what's happening, and you have 6 of them in that lobby. And the circles with your avatar's face move around and coalesce into a match. So when there's someone that is, you know, there are 2 people that are available, then they get grouped and you have a 1v1 match. And sometimes you're going to have 4 people available, so they group and you see them in a bigger circle with divided in halves, and you see it's a 2v2. And during all this, as it's searching, you can always train. So you have a very easy way of basically pressing just one button, and you have a little training room that appears and you're training in the game. It is super cleverly done, especially when you're thinking about Street Fighter V, which is horrible in that aspect, although their new netcode is rolling out today. So we'll see if that fixes some of that. But there's a lot of cleverness going on in ARMS. I just felt like the game itself was a little bit, I didn't find the technicality of the game. And it felt to me like a lot of randomly punching. And I'm sure it isn't. Maybe half an hour isn't enough to find the depth in the game. But I didn't find it. So for me, it felt for half an hour, I was like randomly kind of winning games. And like the throwing of the punches and, angling them to go one direction or another didn't feel like it was fast enough or appropriate enough to be technical. I'm guessing maybe I'm wrong, but it didn't feel like a great core gameplay. So we'll see. Maybe, people will prove me wrong, but I wasn't won over by that aspect of the game. So that's kind of, I don't think I'm going to be buying it.
I mean, it's the core aspect of the game. So if you weren't won over by it, it doesn't sound like it's your type of game.
Yeah, definitely.
That'd be like saying, well, I didn't like the shooting in Destiny, so...
Is a chance that I didn't understand the technical aspects of it. You know, it might be that I just didn't get it. And if I did, I would like it. I think that's why there's a little caveat there. But I'm not, very hopeful that that's actually the case. Hey, there's a Pokemon TCG game that might be coming to mobiles. That's like the convergence of two of your favorite things in the world.
I'd be pretty jazzed if that happened, actually. I haven't touched the Pokemon TCG since it came out in the States, I think in 96, 97. Game came out in 96. I don't know the lag between the Game Boy game coming out and the card game coming out, but it was around the same time. I haven't touched it since. I barely even played it back then. I mostly just collected the cards. But if I could play that on my phone, I'm there.
Would you play this? I mean, in a world of Hearthstone, do you play any other trading card games than Hearthstone?
Out of curiosity? Just Magic from time to time.
Okay. I guess, yeah, I was going to say then it's just another card game, but there's Pokemon, and that's a huge draw, right?
Yeah, I love Pokemon, and I've been... I'm very strange. I missed the boat on a lot of very nerdy activities as I was growing up. I played my first game of Magic when I was 24, and it got really into it. And then 2 years later, I think 2 years, 3 years later, shortly after Hearthstone came out, obviously got very into that. If you know anything about the other podcasts that I do. And so now I enjoy card games. I don't usually go and do a deep dive into really any others than Hearthstone and Magic, but Pokemon, like, because looking back on it, like, oh, here's a game I actually took part in but didn't really play when it originally came out. And so, like, if this comes out and it's a way to actually play the card game, I personally would be very excited to go and finally experience the gameplay of the Pokemon card game.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that are going to be in that same boat.
I think my point was, if I want to play it now, there's a lot of buy-in. I have to go get a bunch of cards myself, and I have to convince my friends to go and get a bunch of cards.
Right. Yeah, and obviously that, you know, the Pokemon, the draw to the Pokemon brand is huge, as we've learned with Pokemon Go, or as we've confirmed with Pokemon Go, and people have been educated to card games with the popularity of Hearthstone, so it's kind of a perfect mix up there. Monster Hunter XX, which I learned is actually pronounced Double Cross, is going to be coming to Switch. And I'm still looking for that one game that is going to make me understand the Monster Hunter type games. I'm not sure, you know, I've tried every demo of Monster Hunter game I could find and never enjoyed it, but maybe that one is going to be it. I doubt it. Maybe there's going to be a demo I'm going to try and be disappointed by again.
It's a franchise that has always interested me, but apparently never enough to get me to go out and actually buy it.
You know, have you tried the demos ever?
No. Okay. I had one friend in college and who was just obsessed with it. And that was as far as my flirtation with Monster Hunter really kind of pursued. It always seemed very cool, but also like if I want WoW to stay in my life, that I don't have the time to even dip my toe in it.
It seems like it's a very time-consuming game. All right, there is more Mario and Raving Rabbids RPG-type thing leaks. Basically, everything has been leaked. And it's funny because they have some marketing slides from an internal presentation, and there's the timeline in one of those, and they're saying, like, I can't remember when it was, like in June, probably around E3, a big reveal. And, you know, it's like, well, we already know all of it. But it's a crossover between Mario and the Raving Rabbids. There's some form of exploration, some form of turn-based combat. There's weird Raving Rabbids versions of Mario, Peach, and other characters. I don't know. It's going to be called Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle. Sure. Why not?
That's pretty much my reaction as well. I don't have a lot to say here. I think the Rabbids are mildly humorous, but I don't need to play a whole game with them.
I think that is the way I would absolutely describe them. Mildly humorous.
Yeah.
We also had a trailer for Splatoon 2's single-player mode. So there's going to be a single-player mode in Splatoon 2, which could be cool for some people if you're not so much into the PvP aspect of the game. And then we move on from Nintendo to the other bits of news. The first one of which is going to be Far Cry 5, which was announced along with a little bit of marketing material. Some fairly cool stuff. It's going to be happening in Montana. There is a town being taken over by a group of religious fanatics. They're Christian fundamentalists, and you have a number of little videos of people from that town basically explaining what's happening. Three different characters. There's a young woman in a bar, there's a priest, and there's a young guy fixing a plane. And it's really well directed. There's a sense of cinematography and drama, which are really well done. There was a piece of marketing material, which was basically The Last Supper, but with those religious fundamentalists. Instead of Christ and the apostles, as we also often see in many instances. And overall, the whole thing was received, I think, pretty well. A lot of people were excited about Far Cry 5, except for a group of special people. I even hesitate even talking about it, but I think it's still worth it. Basically, some extreme members of what I think is fair to call the alt-right or Gamergate are really upset that this is in an anti-white game. And I honestly don't know how much of it is genuine. I'm sure some of that outrage is genuine. And I don't know how much of it is trolling. Like, there's a petition on change.org, which is worded so outrageously that it seems like a troll, but at the same time, you know, it says sad things about our world that I'm looking at this and I'm not certain it's a troll. People demanding more diversity in the roster of bad guys in that game, which is hilariously ironic given the fact that basically the entire Gamergate movement was fighting against diversity and having more representation for different parts of the population in games. So I don't know what to think of this. I don't know if it's like an actual... Every comment I've seen about this seems to be making fun of it. There's no one genuinely, maybe in some recessed dark corners of the internet, there are some people actually upset about this. I'm guessing there are, but I'm wondering if it isn't like a few hundred idiots and the entirety of the rest of the internet looking at them and pointing and saying and being outraged by really a hundred morons. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm having all of the same exact pretty much reactions as you. And the only thing I would add is I'm very excited to play this game because of the setting. I grew up in the South. I grew up going camping and spending a lot of time in like cow pastures and out in the middle of nowhere. And So I saw the trailer for this and I had instantly just the schism of reactions of, oh my God, I cannot wait to have like the American South as this gunplay playground. Like I'm so excited that that's where I'm going to get to go and just unleash.
Wait, Montana isn't in the South.
What's that?
Montana isn't in the South, is it?
No,
it's the same, right? I see what you mean.
Just remove the mountains, and everything is very rural. Okay, it's very much small town farms, pastures, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I'm very excited about that aspect. And at the same, and on the flip side, my schism is, oh man, we didn't really need another representation of where I live as a bunch of religious zealots.
But you know, I think it's like this. It's funny that you say this, and this might be a little bit more political than we want, but I'm fairly sure that that's the reaction that a lot of people get in the Middle East when they see the caricatural terrorist Arabs in half or, you know, 90% of the Western pop culture.
And that is not what I'm arguing against.
I agree with you. It's interesting.
And you're absolutely right. I think it's interesting that I'm having that. I'm talking more about like almost a reaction just within our own country, because I think there's a lot of that discussion being had right now for very obvious reasons. and it's more like I want to poke my California friends and be like, guys, seriously, I've lived there. I've lived both places. We're not all like this. Calm down.
Yeah, you know, I'd say a couple of things. I'm not sure which studio is doing Far Cry 5, but it's Ubisoft as a company. So it's a French company. So you can blame us instead of your Californian friends, I'm sure. And the other thing is, when you look at the game, I'm pretty sure the people fighting those religious zealots are, well, I'm not pretty sure, it is the people from that area. It's like, basically, you took over our town and we're going to, you know, get you out.
100%. I'm talking about the kind of the surface level controversy. Where you have folks from the Gamergate movement and from the alt-right saying that this is some kind of like anti-white and everything that boils up, like talking about this, like this shouldn't be seen as an accurate representation. And if you can just remove that from your mind, just shut up and have fun with it, and if it offends you, don't play it.
Yeah. It's really funny. It's also the parallel between, the minorities representation about this, and now the whites being felt like they're in the minority. I think there's a lot of disconnect between what actually is a minority and why representation matters for a minority and not so much for a group that isn't, you know, that is the dominant group. So basically the game looks really cool, and Far Cry with Far Cry 3 specifically sort of opened up the game to a lot more people, and there were a lot of clever things done in that game. The previous ones were good as well, but 3 and 4 were especially good, and Primal went in a slightly different direction, but 5 is coming back to the modern times. I think there's going to be a lot of fun to be had in this one. It's coming out at the end of the year. The Crew 2 was also announced, by the way, if you didn't realize that The Crew was a successful game. I didn't. I
enjoyed the first Crew.
Yeah, you did? Really?
I had a good time. I like my racing games. I enjoyed the first Crew. Yeah. I liked the open world aspect of it. I love that there was a representation of the 7 Mile Bridge going to the Florida Keys in a video game. Mm-hmm. But that's an extremely personal deep cut, so yeah. Maybe it didn't land on everyone else the same way as it did with me.
What was good about The Crew beyond the open world? Because there's lots of racing games that have gone open world since then.
I think for me, it was just this. It really captured this kind of this desire to get a fast car and drive as fast as you can across the United States.
More than a game like Forza, or I guess it wasn't United States.
Forza's never captured that particular locale. Forza is, for me, as someone who doesn't get to travel a lot and lives in America, Forza is like this, it's the dreamland for cars. It's this beautiful, it's like Middle Earth for cars. and the first Crew ended up being this kind of attainable thing that I could never legally do, because I can't get on Route 66 and drive 150 miles an hour.
I see. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Did you get into the multiplayer aspect of it? Like, did you randomly form groups, or, you know?
No, not really.
Okay, played it solo.
My issue with trying to be have a social experience in driving games, it was very similar to Destiny, except my friends actually played Destiny, but we were never on the same console, whereas no one I know gives nearly any crap about driving games like I do.
But you can play with other people. I think that's one of the interesting aspects of those games, that you can randomly, you know, not for, you know, it's not going to be a love story, but you can meet them for an afternoon and play along for a mission and then go your separate ways. That's more of the, you know, aspect I'm wondering about. Like, did you randomly get into races with different people, or like some events? Because that was a part of the game that we're selling pretty hard.
Yeah, I did. It just wasn't that memorable. Okay. The one that pops into my mind is the one where the dude just tried to run me off the road for the entire mission. So, I mean, griefers still happen, and
okay, like, that so sounds I, like I don't fun. Know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, Forza is my go-to, but I thought The Crew had some unique aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the Gru 2 is going to be available next year, I think, in the first quarter. And Far Cry 5, as I said, is the end of this year. And something that is not going to be coming at the end of this year, however, is Red Dead Redemption 2. It was delayed to spring 2018. And upon hearing that news, the entirety of the Ubisoft offices and the game industry sighed in relief that the the holiday season was saved for many of them.
Gotcha. And the rest of us had no reaction at all because we all knew it was going to be delayed.
Yeah, exactly. It was supposed to come out in like 4 months, and we hadn't seen anything. I mean, I was still holding out a little bit of hope that we would see they were saving it for E3, but yeah, I mean, we're still probably going to be seeing a lot about it at E3, but yeah, anyway, spring 2018, and that means that everyone who's getting their games ready for the holiday season is going to have a chance to sell a little bit more of all of them. Hey, The Witcher is getting a Netflix series. That's like live action drama Netflix series from the original material from the Polish author. Can't remember his name. Actually, I've seen a lot of people being very, very uncertain about this. I'm actually pretty excited.
I need to see a trailer. I need to see how well budgeted this is, because The Witcher's world is, I think, absolutely awesome and so well realized in the game that I just hope it gets the funding that it needs to kind of live up to that kind of spectacle. Mm.
Yeah, it can be a cheap series. It can be a low budget thing.
Right. I hope they go deep. I hope this is like Lord of the Rings. Like, they really don't pull any punches and they just go really deep into the nerdy lore of everything. And I don't know, throw enough butts in there to make everyone happy who wants just another nudity Game of Thrones show. But yeah, overall, why not? Which is a great world for it, and in the grand scheme of RPGs, I think the main character is pretty well defined. You can make some decisions within it, but I think if we're gonna follow Geralt, it's a pretty well defined character.
Well, especially since they're probably going to be following the book series, so it's completely established there. Andrzej Sapkowski's book, by the way, The Witcher. So yeah, I'm, you know, a few, as a friend of mine said, a few years ago, I would have said this is going to be a slam dunk. Since then, the Netflix offering have varied in quality, and I'm not as convinced that it will be great, but I still think there's a good chance it's going to be. So,
come on, Patrick. I mean, back when they had like two series, one was House of Cards, the other was Marco Polo. Did you see Marco Polo? Because it has always varied in quality.
Oh, you think so? I loved Marco Polo. I thought it was brilliant.
I thought it was wicked lame.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So not my jam.
Really? Okay. Well, you know, I really loved it. I thought it was very, very well done and fascinating in many different ways. So, yeah, I was more dissatisfied with the latest Netflix Marvel offerings. Mm. Like, I thought Iron Fist was horrendous. Horrendous. It was terrible.
I had fun with it, and I would like to thank you and the rest of the internet for talking so much smack that by the time I went to go see it, I expected Danny Rand to come out of the TV and hit me in the crotch for watching the show. That's what I expected. That was the level of offense I expected to take.
Well, you're welcome. We lowered your expectations. I can't remember if we mentioned it, but there's also going to be a Castlevania animated series coming out of Netflix. So it seems they're trying to capture something video gamey somewhere. There were rumors about a Zelda series at some point. I think that didn't pan out.
I can't imagine that would be anything other than universally loathed.
Yeah,
if they ever made a Zelda series.
But maybe it means that they're going for other, properties for gaming. And, I mean, we just talked about Destiny. That could be fun, but Overwatch. Imagine a Netflix series, like a short one, 8 episodes, focused on
a continual series that plays out very much like the Avengers that will keep Garrett tuning in every single year.
But then I kind of go back to Iron Fist and how they butchered this.
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's totally fine. They can't all be hits.
South Park is finally coming out. The Fractured But Whole is coming out in October. There's an update for Clash of Clans, which I thought was really interesting. Basically, Supercell just updated Clash of Clans in a way that is super clever. We're getting in a place with mobile games that have, where they have such big communities that it's really hard to create sequels or follow-ups to successful games. It's very reminiscent of what we've seen with MMORPGs, where you build up a community, there's a lot of multiplayer interaction in them, and it's very hard to migrate them to another game. So if Supercell had released Clash of Clans 2, it would have been a very, very risky proposition. I think it would have been pretty much certainly a miss. They would have fractured the community. It would have been really hard to make that game as big a success as Clash of Clans 1 was. So what they did, again, maybe following the model of MMORPGs, is basically put Clash of Clans 2 in Clash of Clans 1. They put in a boat on the shore of the first base, and it was there for a little while, and no one really knew what it was. And then when they updated it to include that full update, you could tap on the boat and go to an entirely new, different, reset base that they called the Builder Base. And some of the systems... It's still Clash of Clans. You're still going to be collecting the elixir and gold. And you're still going to be building stuff, and you're going to have the mechanics where you have to wait and you have the energy and you can pay for gems and all of this crap. But there are some differences in gameplay, not the least of which is when you go attack someone else's base, they also attack yours, and the winner is the one that destroyed the most amount of the other's base. So there is a more competitive aspect to the PvP in this game, where the first one was asymmetrical. And it's interesting because the old base is still there. It's a tap away. You can still work on your old base. But if you don't want to, if you want to start fresh, or if you're a returning player and you want to check it out, you can go to the new base, and it's really just like a Clash of Clans 2. So I thought that approach was very interesting.
They didn't do the EverQuest 1 mistake. Good.
EverQuest 2, you mean, yeah.
Or sorry, EverQuest 2, yeah. Yes. Numbers, how do they work?
But you know, that's absolutely the reason it interested me so much, is that you have the exact same problem, and I'm wondering if some other games on mobile aren't going to have to do some things that are similar. Now, of course, Supercell is a genuinely developer-focused company, so they also have other games, and they released Clash Royale last year, which was a huge success, as we know. But yeah, to redo the existing successes, it's a much more difficult thing to do, and that approach seems like the right one.
Yeah, there you go.
ZeniMax is suing Samsung now. They're claiming that some of their tech was originating from id Software. And as you know, I didn't think that their claims on the original Oculus trial or suit were all that believable. But I mean, there were questions, I would say. These ones seem like just plain, all right, we got money from Facebook with Oculus. Let's see if we can get something from Samsung. When you read the claim, it's basically like, oh, well, Carmack was talking with a friend at one point, and they were having drinks, and they were like, oh, you know what would be great for VR on mobile? Yeah, that would be awesome. All right. And now we have tech that was conceived at id. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is a valid claim. It seemed certainly seemed that there was in the case of Oculus. You know, they did won that that suit. They did win that suit, although not exactly on the patent aspect of it. So, but still, I mean, I don't know. It's starting to look money grubby for ZeniMax.
It's fishy. There's an odor to this for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right. But who knows? We're not attorneys or juries or judges, so maybe they do have a valid claim. What else? What else? Grand Theft Auto tops 80 million units sold. That's sell-in, but still not sell-through to customers, but sell-in to stores. But still, 80 million, holy crap. That is an incredible number. Overwatch had the anniversary event. It's been 1 year. 1 year. So do you regret leaving the podcast dedicated to Overwatch yet?
I don't have that much to say about new skins. So no, not really.
Okay, fair enough. Having a lot of fun in it, obviously, personally. But that is, you know, Overwatch, I do a whole show dedicated to that game. So if you want to hear me rave and gush about Overwatch and the fact that it's already been a year. And I will say one thing, however, that I did say in Overwatchers. I went and looked at my videos I did for when the beta first started a year and a half ago. And holy crap, was I bad. I was so bad. It's painful. It's cringeworthy. You know,
I mean, I would challenge everyone listening to just record yourself playing a new game. And if you stick with it for some time, go back and watch yourself playing it because it is hilarious.
It really is. And you know, you don't realize it's surprising how much you don't realize how much you progress. Because I was really feeling like, you know, maybe I got a little bit better, but like I'm watching those videos and I'm like, what the hell are you doing, Patrick? Just look around a little bit, like go there or do this. And like, I'm getting angry at myself. So I think that was a little bit, you know, it was a positive thing.
Yeah, I had a very similar reaction like that probably like 6 or 7 years ago now. Mm-hmm. After I had played StarCraft II for quite a while, I went back and played Warcraft III. And it was just like, oh my God, I don't know how I ever beat this game with the way I used to play. Because now I'm like I'm using control groups and box selecting a lot faster and the shift queuing and all the stuff that I didn't know about or do. And it also made me feel less proud of ranks I have achieved in games like StarCraft and Heroes, because there's probably someone out there playing as poorly as I did.
Oh, that's funny. It made me feel a little bit better about what I've achieved in Overwatch, because it was like, oh, I did progress. I did achieve something. But you know, I wonder if there isn't something there to be explored by game developers, because it's always so hard in those games to show you that you're doing, to show you something positive. And I'm wondering if there isn't something to the idea that, I don't know, capturing some aspect of your gameplay, maybe not video, but numbers or something, making them available throughout your career, and or maybe showing you, hey, this is how you were when you first started, and now you're doing so much better, not just over your average now, but from what you were doing 6 months or a year ago or 2 years ago even. I don't know. Maybe there's something there, but it was
maybe, just more robust stat tracking would be interesting. Just being able to even go back and look at a certain range of my stats and something like Heroes of the Storm would be cool. Be like, right. Here was your stats in the tech alpha versus now. Wow, you're better.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. I think that is going to be it for us for this episode. A relatively short one. Of course, there is E3 right around the corner, which, by the way, I'm going to be covering with Scott, as we often do. We're going to be covering the most of the conferences live. I might put the the commentary on the this feed. I didn't in the past few years because I figured no one cared, but Scott puts them up on his Boob Show, and people seem to appreciate them. And I've heard from other people that they like when we comment on tech conferences and stuff like that. So I'm probably going to put them up on this feed as well, the one I participate in. And if you want to listen, then please do. And if you don't care about that, we will have an episode where we summarize everything that we've seen at E3 up on the feed after all the conferences have come and gone. So rest assured, everything will still be there.
I had to stifle a laugh because I like it when you talk about Scott's Boob Show, and you make it sound like you said Boob Show.
Well, it's either the Boob Show or the Poop Show. It's one of the two. So I'm glad that you went the boob route because the other one is not as fun. All right. Talking about fun, how about you tell the fine people listening where they can find your podcasts, Garrett?
Oh, there well, I mean, there's one place to find all of them. It's amove.tv. That is AMOVE.TV. All of my podcasts are over there. If you like Hearthstone, check out The Angry Chicken. If you like Heroes of the Storm, check out Into the Nexus. And if you want to hear me talk more Destiny, the most recent episode of my solo show, The Angry Nerd, is just about that. If you want to hear me ramble on about why I'm really into the concept and art direction of the new worlds that we're going to be traveling to, I did a pretty deep dive into my art nerdiness there.
Ooh, cool. I'm going to go listen to that. I am Not Patrick on Facebook and Twitter. You can find me there. I'm also available on frenchspin.com. That's the website where I put up the shows I produce. If you enjoyed the little bit of political discussion we had in the middle of this show, you might enjoy the Fittest Club, where we talk about politics and world events with people from different countries, different backgrounds. The latest episode, we had someone from Brazil and a couple of my conservative friends from the US in an effort to burst our filter bubbles, because I'm in a more liberal bubble, I would say. We had a couple of interesting conversations there. And I will also be putting, I think, this show on YouTube, just the audio, you know, with a static image. But I have a process to automate that now. And some people have expressed interest in having them on YouTube. So you can find me at youtube.com/Patrick Beja there. There are French shows and English shows, but, you know, you can choose which ones you listen to. So that's useful as well for some people. Thank you very much for listening to this episode, and we will be back with the craziness of E3 in just a very short while. Talk to you then. Bye.
Take care.